Did Steve Jobs fake his death? Or is he just faking the lives of everyone else? You are listening to Notes from the Uncanny Valley with Gib Strange. Damn it, I left my selfie stick in the car, says a nearby voice. Someone once told me that the difference between travelers and tourists is that travelers bring things, while tourists take things. Mostly they take pictures. They also take away the silence. Only while their picture is being taken and they have to hold a smile for a moment is there any quiet. Then the chatter resumes. That's the best shot yet. I read recently that 1 trillion pictures will be taken this year. Excuse me. I open my eyes to find a physically fit young man looking down at me. Would you mind taking our picture? I look around. Surprised to discover that I'm the only other person here at Lookout Point to ask. I look back at the man, and beyond to his girlfriend, who is leaning on the guardrail that protects people from falling off the precipice. I observe that this attractive young couple has invested heavily in hair care products. The man is wearing a form-fitting gray t-shirt with an advertisement on it. The woman is chewing gum. My side of the interaction begins with the very basics. Hello, I say. Hi, they respond in unison. Smiles are exchanged, and soon the favor has been asked a second time. Impressed with the man's forward thrust, I rise from the sanctuary of my park bench in a quiet daze. Soon I am handed an expensive gadget, and, for a moment, I consider running off with it. I imagine looking at the images stored on the camera. Perhaps there is an interesting narrative in the days leading up to this unfortunate moment when they were separated from their recording device by a crazed stranger at Lookout Point. Or would I just find vacation selfies taken against various local backdrops and hotel room vanity pornography? Instead of stealing the camera, I decide to take seriously the job I've been enlisted to do. I will capture a digital record of the happy couple in front of the city to serve as their prosthetic memory. After briefly familiarizing myself with the buttons, I hold the camera screen at eye level. As I compose my shot, the couple transitions into well-rehearsed poses. The man knows that the shot will be more flattering if he drops his chin slightly, and the woman's smile looks like a toothpaste advertisement. The couple are as still as mannequins as my finger hovers over the trigger. Seconds pass. I'm enjoying the perfect still life. Only a gentle breeze moving the woman's hair gives it away. I really don't want this to end. This naked silence. A look of uncomfortable confusion begins to emerge, especially on the woman's face. They begin to laugh in an almost perfect Kodak moment, and yet I wait. I do not take the picture. Nervously, they turn to each other and laugh again. Then they look back at me and force a third laugh, as if to test me, to see if I will return the laugh and confirm that this is some kind of joke. But I don't, and it's not. Soon their composure begins to slip. Their patience is faltering, and still, the moment has not yet. Now, an electronic sound mimicking the mechanical film shutters of yesteryear is emitted, and the screen goes dark. Then the picture appears on the viewfinder. Yes, there it is. All the tension, every truthful detail, expressed in their beautiful, confused, angry faces. I'm grateful that they invited me to be their documentarian, and proud of the active approach I've taken to the role. I'm still admiring the painful accuracy of my work when the man suddenly interrupts. He's holding his hand out. He must want his camera back. I press the button, but it doesn't light up. Nevertheless, the door closes and the elevator descends. It stops on the third floor, and a middle-aged woman in her pajamas gets on. She also hits one. I watch as she pushes the button a second time. The button remains dark. As the car descends, she looks up at me and says with a smile, "I guess we're headed to one." "Maybe," I say. I'm definitely enjoying the suspense. Security companies prey on insecurity. A couple years ago, a local company was hired to patrol these buildings at night. Their exact function is unclear. Primarily, it seems to be the suggestion of safety. Should a situation arise, I suppose they might act as a liaison between tenant and police. These night patrol positions are usually filled by geeky young men and women, made even geekier by yellow and black nylon uniforms that swoosh when they walk. They bike from building to building, so bicycle helmets are also a big part of the costume. As these scrawny figures walk down the hall, one gets the sense that when they're not at work, they're at home playing video games, probably first-person shooter games. It's the fixed determination in their faces that gives it away. Clearly, they're leading double lives as remote-controlled avatars, turning corners in virtual landscapes and firing digital weapons at artificial enemies. In fact, this very suspicion is being reinforced right now down in the office, where one of the patrolmen is telling Matt, the nighttime desk attendant, about the recent unveiling of a new virtual reality helmet. Matt, a pleasant, easygoing guy in his early 40s, is listening with interest, but is not nearly as enthusiastic about the announcement as the patrol kid, who is positively glowing. The two often talk about movies and video games. Once I overheard the kid explaining his theory that the second two Matrix films never happened. After they finally say goodnight, Matt turns to me and says, "Sorry about that, man, what's up?" A good question, I think, as I rub my eyes. What was I starting to say before the patroller came in the office with news from the gamer convention? Oh yes, now I remember. "Matt, what do you know about my neighbor in 527?
"Big boy? Well, not much. I know there's been some complaints about him. I think somebody's probably got their eye on him, you know what I mean? Why, is he fighting with the guy downstairs again?"
"That's one way of putting it, Matt. Another would be that the fight is between good and evil, and the battleground is this poor man's psyche," I say as something somewhere between a laugh and a sigh escapes my chest.
"Why didn't you say something while Kevin was here?"
I look out the window and watch the rent-a-patroller giggle into his walkie-talkie as he unlocks his bike from the rack. "Yeah, I guess I wasn't thinking, Matt." Poor Matt. I've noticed no one lasts very long doing his position. The unspoken parts of the job description are conflict management and bereavement counselor. "I know you're probably not the person to ask about this, but if this guy's off his meds, do you think he could be dangerous?"
He might be off his meds, but violent? Man, I don't think so. Why? Just something I heard him ranting about earlier.
What did he say?
Something about stabbing the guy downstairs in the head.
You have been listening to Notes from the Uncanny Valley with Gip Strange.